You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, love them or hate them, musicals have been one of the most durable movie genres for almost a century. We'll talk with a film historian about how they came to be, their rise and a little bit fall, and what's changed over the years. First, Republicans in the state Senate voted yesterday to reject Brad Paff, Governor Evers picked to head the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. It was a party-line vote, all Democrats voting to confirm him, all Republicans voting against. It's now not clear whether the governor's eight other unconfirmed cabinet picks will get approved either. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Senate Republicans said they're probably going to do it. Yesterday they did it. Tell us what happened.
So Republicans have been raising some concerns with Brad Paff for, you know, several weeks now. They've sparred with him publicly, particularly over a delay in state funding for a suicide prevention program for farmers. They said that he was politicizing that issue when he pushed back on that delay. They actually flagged for Governor Evers late last week, that they didn't believe that Paff had the number of votes necessary to be confirmed, even though he was on the calendar for a confirmation vote. So this has been something that's been brewing for quite a bit now.
Let's give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, Republican, talking about this yesterday.
There's a whole slew of things, I think, that anybody could bring forth, but you got to be comfortable. And I think as we stand here today, there's a number of members of the majority that just aren't comfortable with Brad Paff.
Brad Paff was the nominee. How common is it, Laurel, for the state Senate, that's their job to approve or reject these cabinet nominees, how common is it for them to reject a nominee?
It's incredibly uncommon. So this was the first time since at least 1987, and that's actually as far back as the records that are accessible go, so it actually could be even longer than that, that a governor's cabinet member has been fired by the Senate. So, of course, the Senate has the power to confirm members of the governor's cabinet. People who aren't confirmed still continue serving in the capacity unless the Senate votes to fire them. So this is a really, really unusual move and kind of another step in the conflict that we've seen between Republican lawmakers and the governor.
Governor Evers attended this hearing, which is unusual. We'll talk about that. But he talked about the vote afterward and what it means for his other cabinet picks yesterday.
And to think that they're going to have to keep their mouth shut for the next, who knows, 4 years in order to get approved by the Senate, that is just absolute bullshit.
All right, strong language there from the governor. What do you make of his response?
Well, that's really uncharacteristic language from the governor. We haven't really seen him react that strongly to anything thus far in the months of his administration. You know, he said that reporters were asking him, what's the next step here? What are you going to do about who leads the State Department of Agriculture? He said, I can't even think about that right now. I'm so upset about what happened today. And he said that in his belief, this was a vote against the farmers of Wisconsin. A number of farming groups, including the Wisconsin Dairy Business Association, which is a powerful industry group, had come out in support of Paff. And that's something that Evers really continued pointing to, saying lawmakers were working against the interests of the industry.
And there are a bunch of other cabinet picks, as the governor was referencing, they're still unconfirmed. Some have been confirmed. What are some that might also be subject to being rejected by the Senate?
So there are a couple that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has flagged as potentially being problematic for coupled, you know, kind of a variety of reasons. One is the State Department of Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson. Lawmakers aren't happy with his past work as a transportation lobbyist. Another is the DHS Secretary Andrea Palm. Some lawmakers have raised concerns about one of her deputies and some of the work that the deputy has done. Professional Regulation Secretary Don Krim has had some pushback because of a child abuse charge that she had against her several years ago. So these are some of the things that lawmakers are saying could lead to a similar situation as we saw with Paff this week.
And before we move on from this, the PATH nomination, some Republicans in the Senate had voted, I understand, in committee to pass him through to the whole Senate. And Democrats were definitely targeting them with messages about why they would change from their committee vote to the full body vote. What did we hear about that?
So there was a really kind of protracted debate during the conversation yesterday where Democrats were trying to call out those Republicans that had voted in favor of PATH during committee. They wanted to actually quote some of the positive things that Republicans said in the committee to sort of put them on the spot. Republicans who control the Senate chamber barred Democrats from quoting from committee action. They said that that wasn't something that should be allowed on the Senate floor under Senate rules. Democrats pushed back and said that's something that they've always been able to do. That would be contrary to previous practice. So there was definitely a lot of back and forth and an attempt by Democrats to say, hey, a number of you voted in favor of PATH not that long ago. Why are you changing your tune now?
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. Let's move on from that confirmation and touch on efforts to limit the governor's veto power. What did we see yesterday on that?
So this would be a constitutional amendment in Wisconsin that would bar the governor from using his veto pen to increase state spending. It's in response to the governor actually doing that in the last state budget. He used his veto pen to increase the education budget in Wisconsin by about $65 million. Lawmakers, particularly Republican lawmakers, believe that's an abuse of his power. So under this proposal, this governor and you know, forthcoming governors would not be able to take that kind of action with the budget. This is a pretty lengthy process. Getting a constitutional amendment in place, it would have to pass the Senate as it did yesterday, pass the Assembly, do that process all over again during the next legislative session. So it has to pass during two consecutive sessions, both bodies, and then be approved by a statewide voter referendum.
Speaking of vetoes in the state assembly, there are rumblings about an attempt to override some of the governor's budget vetoes, maybe as soon as tomorrow. What can you tell us about that?
So there are three potential budget vetoes on the assembly calendar for tomorrow. They all are stemming from the state budget. They all have to do with mental health funding in Wisconsin. They are things that Republican lawmakers in the assembly think the governor changed in the budget that are kind of to the detriment of mental health care in Wisconsin. I think the big one is the fact that he vetoed funding for a proposed mental health crisis center in northern Wisconsin, $15 million, and redirected that to an existing facility in Madison to expand that. Republican lawmakers have raised some concerns about the travel time for some individuals and why that northern Wisconsin facility was necessary. The governor says the expansion of the Madison facility should be sufficient. So that's kind of what lawmakers are trying to go at tomorrow. I think the interesting thing to note there, though, is they need a two-thirds vote to override the governor, and that would require Democrats to get on board and vote with them on that.
And finally, a couple of bills headed to Governor Evers' desk. I want to touch on one of them, a change to Wisconsin's drunk driving penalties when it comes to a homicide, I think, while driving drunk. What do we see there?
So that would require a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 5 years for anyone who kills someone else while driving drunk. This is something that lawmakers have been discussing for several years in terms of kind of increasing the penalties on drunk driving in Wisconsin. So that is now headed to the governor's desk.
All right, a lot to keep our eyes on, Laurel. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter. She was with us today to talk about the state Senate vote yesterday to reject DATCAP Secretary Designee Brad PATH. That's the Department of Agriculture, Trade, Consumer Protection, and some other action in the state legislature over the last few days. Coming up, a Milwaukee pinball expert set a new Guinness record on one of his favorite machines, but the record wasn't his main goal. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a Milwaukee man who spent more than 30 hours straight playing pinball, all for a good cause. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Today's story comes from our friends at To the Best of Our Knowledge. They introduce us to a Wisconsin woman who gave her kidney to a stranger.
Last year in March, on Facebook, there was a little girl in our town that needed a kidney. My daughter looked at me, she goes, you know, Mom, you would match up with her blood type. So I called the hospital where she was working through, and that's how the process started.
This is Missy McKenna.
I had to go through all these blood tests and all these tests and everything. And then they tell me the little girl, she had gotten a kidney and that her transplant was going forward. And I felt like gone so far through the process. I said, okay, that's fine. I've come this far. I'm not going to stop.
This is such an incredible story, an incredible case.
This is Missy's surgeon, Josh Mesrich.
I have so many donors tell me this is the best thing they've ever done. And of course, that's my goal.
To lose a kidney?
That part.
Why do they think it's the best thing they've ever done?
Because they're saving these lives. It really is. It is like the kind of person who would run into a burning building to save someone. Now, the donors do really well. When you look at the numbers, the risks are low. But it's still surgery. It's still this leap of faith. There's going to be a recovery. There's going to be pain. Who has a month out of their life that they can go through this? But I do want to be clear. Our donors do very, very well. And I hope your listeners will get to hear it.
All right. So this is the operating room. There's our patient, actually.
Missy, how are you?
Put it right on your face and let you just fill those lungs up with that good stuff.
Once a surgery starts, it really is this puzzle. You're really focused on doing the case. You're not thinking at all about, my gosh, this is a person with kids or with parents or something like that. I think when things go disastrously wrong, then you start to get these moments of thinking about their family. But during an operation, you're really focused on the task at hand. You almost don't feel like you're operating on a human. You're just trying to put the puzzle together.
Psoas to the right, diaphragm in front of us, kidney to our right, spleen to the left. We're past the adrenal now. He just doesn't want to stick his blade into the diaphragm. It takes 1 millisecond to put a hole in the diaphragm with the harmonic. We're almost ready to start flipping the kidney. We're in really good shape.
I think every surgeon has to have this proverbial box. And in this box, you can kind of put your complications and you can keep them there. You need to be able to close that box so you can go home and be with your family, be with your kids, and not just be constantly agonizing. But you also need to be able to open that box and be with the patient, see them every day and say, we're going to get through this.
Once we get the kidney out, we'll move it to the back, flush it. That's critical. Once it's flushed and on ice, then we can relax. All right, are we good? Is everyone good? We got everyone we need? Push down all the way across. I think you're great there, dude. Perfect. Fire in the hole. Love that. There it is, left kidney, 2 arteries. I'm happy with it, Clark. I think it looks great. It'll fly across the country, and then it'll get plugged in, and it'll start working right away. It's just awesome.
You know, that's amazing. I always want to help people. So I'm glad that I could save somebody's life. You know, I guess being a part of somebody else, I don't even think about it. I just hope that their life is more enjoyable.
This story about kidney donation came from our friends at To the Best of Our Knowledge from WPR and PRX. It was produced by Shannon Henry Kleiber. To hear the full story, and trust me, you do, go to ttbook.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a classic game of pinball. The flippers, the bells, the skyrocketing point totals. Unless you're me, then they don't skyrocket. It can be fun for a few rounds or even for an afternoon. But how about more than 30 hours of pinball? That's exactly what Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee accomplished just this past weekend. And Ryan actually had a bigger goal in mind. Ryan joins us now in our studio in Milwaukee. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Set the stage for us. Tell us about this record you set, an actual Guinness record for playing pinball.
I did, yeah. It was actually 32 hours and 2 minutes.
Wow.
But didn't feel like a minute beyond 32 hours and 1 minute. So it just flew by.
And this is a record. I understand you were in contact with the previous record holder as you did this.
I was. It was amazing to see. I mean, the community support from, yeah, not only the previous record holder, the person who did the call outs, like the voiceovers, Ed Robertson from Bare Naked Ladies on the pinball machine itself. He got on the Twitch stream. We had teams of people working in 3, 4, and 5s. For 32 hours straight. It was just a really overwhelming to see the community support on this.
Now, we'll get into the details and logistics here in a bit, but there was a bigger cause. What were you playing for here?
Absolutely. So through extralife.org, which is an organization that exists solely to give money to Children's Wisconsin, formerly Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and they have one really big kind of fundraising campaign every year on the same weekend and kind of surrounding weekends as well, where they encourage people to donate. 100% of the funds raised from this and from other endeavors go right to children's hospitals all across the U.S.
And you had a personal connection with the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin.
I did, yeah. Just a few years ago, our son Alex got E. coli, his kidneys shut down, and Children's of Wisconsin saved his life. So we were just, overwhelmed and kind of blown away by the incredible care that he got at Children's Wisconsin. I think it's a terrible, traumatic experience for both the patient, for Alex, and for families when people have to go through this. But we really just want kids all across Wisconsin to have the phenomenal care that he got at Children's.
Talking to Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee about his Guinness record playing pinball, as you just heard, raising money for the Children's Hospital there. All right, Ryan, what table were you playing here? What pinball machine?
It was called Black Knight Sword of Rage.
I've seen that in the bars. Yeah.
Absolutely. It was, made right in the Midwest, just down in Chicago. And then apparently they did a pretty good job with it because that table held up surprisingly well for that much play.
And according to the conditions, you have to play the same game the whole time, but you got a backup, right?
I did, yeah. The very kind people at the Garcade in Menominee Falls loaned us a backup one, which we didn't have to use, but it sat there. So in case ours started throwing out smoke or sparks or anything, we had an extra one there.
Now, people might be wondering, wait a minute, 32 hours. Aren't there certain, physical necessities one has to attend to?
So, we had a lot of volunteers helping with that, too. My representative, Jonathan Prostoff, came a couple days before. He helped me time how long it would take to run down to the bathroom and run back. We got
Guinness
that down to
this.
About – absolutely. So I was able to bank about 5 minutes every hour to use for things like that. And, man, it was it took a whole team to get this going.
Now, you did this – was this at a coffee shop, did I see?
It was at Bounce Milwaukee in Bayview, which my wife and I own.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And – speaking of coffee, were you I assume I would be caffeinated if I tried to do something like this, which I wouldn't. Were you heavily caffeinated to stay alert 32 hours?
I thought that I would be. We actually got a great coffee donation from Anodyne here in Milwaukee, but I didn't need it. I got through 32 hours and probably could have gone a little bit longer. But my 5-year-old Fiona was, yanking at my pants leg to get me to come home. So I was able to do it without caffeine, but really appreciate that donation and really all the volunteers that stepped up to help.
Now, you play a lot of pinball. Was this some of your best quality gaming or is this all about the quantity?
Boy, I have more enthusiasm for pinball than I do talent. So I appreciate you leading in with by saying that I was a pinball expert, but that might not be totally true. There are many better players out
pinball
there.
Pinball aficionado.
Aficionado is perfect, yeah, at least prior to my attempt. I still do appreciate pinball, although I have taken a break from that one specific game for at least a few days here.
I've had experience in my life where I play, say, a computer game, like Civilization, and if I play it too long, I lay down and close my eyes to go to bed for the night, and I just see the screen in front of me. Was it like that for you? Were you, like, visualizing pinball every moment you closed your eyes?
I thought that I would be, and I didn't, so I slept for about 14 hours straight. I don't remember anything about that. But yeah, thankfully I didn't have the call-outs or anything still stuck in my head. But yeah, I peaked in terms of skill about 7 or 8 hours in, and then it was just a slow, steady decline into going through the motions towards the end. But it really was a great experience, and it was all the volunteers that kind of kept me going. I kept thanking them, for showing up at 3 in the morning. I looked around and there were 6 people up there.
Nice.
Not just standing there looking bored, but really, really into the idea of supporting this great cause. And also a little bit frustrated because right about the time for a few hours before we were going to break that record, the server to take donations actually went down. And I was joking about it on our Twitch stream, like, oh, somebody, you know, hacked into the server and brought it down. But as it turns out, they really did.
Somebody hacked the fundraising server?
My guess is that it cost Children's of Wisconsin and all the other hospitals and organizations around the U.S. that benefit from this millions of dollars. So if you would like to donate, you can do so at extra-life.org. You can search for my name, Ryan Clancy, or really any of the people raising funds and still donate. So we are keeping that fundraising link up at least through the weekend.
You've got this Guinness record now for the most time consecutively spent playing pinball. Do you expect it to be broken anytime soon?
I hope that it is. I mean, I for bragging purposes, I suppose when I go out to bars, it's nice to introduce myself as a Guinness record holder. But yeah, really the point of this was to raise money through Extra Life. I would love it. You know, let me have it for a couple of weeks or months. But if somebody wants to come along and break that record, please just do, raise some good funds for it. The previous holder, Wayne Johns, was a great guy. He had raised money for prostate cancer research. I hope that somebody takes it but does it with good intent.
You worry about carpal tunnel. How are you feeling after 32 hours machine?
I was hurting about 8 hours in.
Really?
And we had a retired occupational therapist. Her name is Barb Coyle, and I am so indebted to her because I was putting all my weight on my wrists, and she came up and yelled at me and straightened out my wrists and, fed me ibuprofen. Pretty much poured it down my throat, and I'm really indebted to her and all the volunteers.
If you were to try something like this again, what machine would you reach for?
Oh boy, I don't know. I guess the next greatest one that comes out. So I really like the Deadpool pinball machine too. It's a ton of fun.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us. Congratulations on the fundraiser and your record.
Thanks so much. Abolish ICE.
It's Ryan Clancy, co-owner of Bounce Milwaukee. We talked to him today about setting a new Guinness World Record for playing pinball and raising money for the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk with a film historian about how the musical genre has changed over the years, and hear some of your favorites, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Whether it's Singing in the Rain, Swing Time, Chicago, or any of the hundreds of choices in between, a lot of people have a favorite movie musical. The genre has been around for nearly a century now. It's given us some of the most iconic moments in film. While singing and dancing have always been part of the equation, a lot has changed about musicals over the years. Some of that's been due to artistry and risk-taking. Other times, it's just been smart business. Janine Basinger is chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University and the founder of the Wesleyan Cinema Archives. She spends part of her year in Madison. Her latest book is The Movie Musical. Janine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, this book, Janine, is clearly a labor of love for you. How did you fall in love with the movie musical?
Just the way anyone would do who is my age, by putting my little self in a seat in a movie theater and just eating Walnettos and sitting there watching them play out. I started going to movies when I was very little, and musicals were very popular in those days, and I just fell in love with them. The color, the movement, everything about them just seemed to me exactly what you would want in life.
What was the first movie musical that you remember really making that impression on you?
I think my clearest memory is a Betty Grable musical, Springtime in the Rockies, and my father took me to that. It was a beautiful, popping Technicolor movie, and that one is very clear to me, although I had also seen Holiday Inn and some other early musicals that I liked, but the power of the color really is clear in my memory for a Betty Grable musical.
there's a lot of movies with you know, somebody singing a song here and there, but it sounds like that doesn't necessarily mean they're a musical. Do you have a rule of thumb for how we define what a musical is?
It has to really be dedicated to expressing its story and its characters through musical performance. Just having someone get up and do a single number or just do a little dance or do some kind of musical thing in a context doesn't make a movie a musical. And I had to think about this a lot. I mean, it really hadn't occurred to me, but a real touchstone for me was the movie Gilda. Rita Hayworth is fantastic in that movie. She was a musical star, and she does two actual numbers in it. But the film is not a musical. It's a film noir. Its purpose is not to give you musical presentation. It uses her doing that to tell the story and make the story more dramatic. So a real musical is like Fred Astaire or Judy Garland or Gene Kelly. And it's all, everything is about music and the presentation of music. So, you know, some of these things become opinion, you know, where do you draw the line? But you, when you sit and watch hundreds of musicals, which I've done and which I did for this book, it does become clear that this intends to be a musical movie. This does not.
Talking to Janine Basinger, her new book is called The Movie Musical. It is a comprehensive look at the history of movie musicals. Janine, we won't hit all of those 100 movies, but I want to hit some of the high points anyway. You just mentioned Fred Astaire, so let's go to him and give a listen. I think he's one of your favorites. Here's a little taste of Fred Astaire here.
Someday, when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Fred Astaire there in Swing Time. He and Ginger Rogers and other dance partners helped push the musical forward. Can you talk about Fred Astaire as part of the history of the movie musical?
Fred Astaire is one of the most important people because he was someone who had a very strong and clear idea about how dance should be presented in film. It should be a frame around the dancer so you could see the dancer head to toe and not break the dance up into little pieces showing feet and then hands and then heads or cutting away to the audience. He said, either the camera will dance or I will dance. And he made people take dance seriously and see it as a whole coherent performance, which is why Gene Kelly, himself a really important person in the history of dance, said, look, it all starts with Fred Astaire. And, of course, he's such a great dancer, and he loved cinema. He would use slow motion. He would use all kinds of tricks, but he wanted the dance to be respected, and I love him. Yes, you're right. He is definitely my favorite of them all, I believe.
And movies like 42nd Street, you talk a lot about that. I understand that was a different cinematic approach with more people and more spectacle. Here's a bit from the title number.
Those dancing feet on the avenue, I'm taking it to 42nd Street, and the beat of dancing.
How did the approach to 42nd Street differ from what we just heard about Fred Astaire?
Well, it's completely different. The creator of the musical numbers, Busby Berkeley, had a single-eye camera kind of presentation. And for him, it was all about everything inside the frame becoming a formation or a kaleidoscopic look. And it was less about a human being a great dancer and more about a camera looking at things that moved inside the frame mathematically, creating patterns for you to see. So they're really very different, and both were great, but there was no place for the Busby Berkeley to kind of go once people got tired of it. And it was spectacular and wonderful, but Astaire, of course, lasted forever, and Busby Berkeley's approach faded away, although we still do appreciate him today.
I want to invite our listeners to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite movie musical? Do you have a favorite performer in movie musicals? Call 800-642-1234. Janine, for a lot of the period you cover in your book, musicals were a genre, maybe the genre. These were a dominant force in movies for decades, right?
Absolutely. Especially during the war years, musicals were particularly important, and they helped people forget their troubles about the war. You entered into the theater, and things were more lighthearted. They were beautiful. They were colorful. It was an important part of really war morale during World War II. But musicals, once sound became available, really reached out to audiences and replaced a lot of vaudeville, a lot of things they had been able to see before. But then they began to seem old-fashioned or trivial or too simple. They seemed to become sillier to people during when you got into the 1960s, and fewer films were being made. They were expensive to make, and people wanted seriousness, or they wanted social commentary more. They wanted a different kind of musical, and that became a problem because once the musical decides to become really serious, it's not that it couldn't, but it became more of a challenge for Hollywood filmmakers.
Yeah, you've got a chapter title I love, The Death of the Musical?
Yes. People were always pronouncing it dead. And, you know, it did kind of die down, but it never really went away. And when I went through all of the releases carefully, I realized, good heavens, there were more musicals being released during all this allegedly death period than anybody realized. It's just that they didn't do very well, and they weren't people's favorite kinds of musical presentation the way they had once been. And we weren't creating all these fabulous musical stars like Astaire and Kelly and Judy Garland and everybody. That just wasn't happening anymore.
Before we bring on our callers at 800-642-1234, Janine, I'm going to say three words to you, and then I'm going to duck. Those three words are la, la, land.
That's all right. I'm expecting. I think a lot of people are dying to interview me about La La Land because I had the nerve to say, with all due respect to the filmmakers and the things in the film that are wonderful, I really did not like that movie. I don't want to have a musical in which the people in it are not great singers and dancers. What's the point? You know, I can thump around the room myself and I can dance. Don't ask me to sing. You would lose listeners in all directions.
Same.
That was not, for me, a successful musical, and it did not have the joy. It did not have the musical presentation. It didn't have the energy. And I know that a lot of people loved it, and it's been one of the things that has caused people to be attracted to my book. I mean, it's like, because it did very well at the box office, and many critics pronounced it as the revitalization of the musical film. But it didn't really do anything new, and it didn't do the old things as well as the old films did. And there was no Fred Astaire in there. There was no Judy Garland. There was no Gene Kelly. I'm sorry, everybody who loved it, God bless you. I'm sorry. But I did not love it, and that's my opinion.
We're talking to Janine Basinger, professor of film studies at Wesleyan University, author of the new book, The Movie Musical. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite movie musical or two you'd like to share with us, or a favorite triple threat singer, dancer, actor? It's a tall order to be a musical star. Do you want to see more musicals made today? Do you like the classics and you don't think we can bring them back? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, talk to you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Janine Basinger, film studies professor at Wesleyan University, author of the new book, The Movie Musical. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite musical? Who's your favorite musical performer? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Susan starts us off in Appleton. Susan, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share a couple of my favorite musicals. It's been one of my favorite movie categories for a long time. And Three Little Words was one of my favorite with Fred Astaire and Red Skelton. And it was based on a true story of two music writers that joined up together. And it has some great music in it. And then I loved a newer version of a musical, Newsies. And again, that one I don't think was a really big hit, but to me it was amazing, the dancing and the singing in there.
Susan,
so
thanks. Thank you so much for sharing those. Janine, Three Little Words and Newsies.
I think those are great choices. I immediately knew as soon as she said Three Little Words. Now, here's a real musical fan. Three Little Words is one of those unpretentious, wonderful movies that came out during those years of the Hollywood studio system that, in fact, just has impeccable musical numbers, one after another, with Astaire, Red Skelton, Debbie Reynolds does a little number when she's unknown. It's just a very entertaining, Vera Ellen dances beautifully. It's one of the really good examples of how a high level of musical film could be made in the Hollywood studio system. Very entertaining. And Newsies did not do well. It was one of the films that came out at a time when people weren't caring as much, but it had fantastic dancing. So she made two really good choices.
Thanks for the call, Susan. We'll go to Dan now in Drummond. Dan, hi.
Hi. Well, for me, and I can't explain why, but Bridget Jones is, to me, one of the top musicals that I love.
Dan, thanks. I'm guessing Dan's not alone with picking Brigadoon?
I love Brigadoon. I love Brigadoon. It was, at the time, a disappointment because they wanted to really go and shoot it on location. And musicals were becoming not quite as popular, and they decided to save money and shoot it on the back lot at Metro. The music of Brigadoon is so beautiful, and the dancing with Sid Charisse and Gene Kelly is fabulous. And Van Johnson, a performer I like a lot, who could really sing and dance, does a great little number with a chorus of other men. And I think it's very romantic and beautiful. And sometimes, you know, people don't like that in movies, and I always try to show this to my students, and sometimes I always tell them, you're a bunch of heartless little beasts, because they're like, no, but then I see it actually does get to them. It's a beautiful story about love, and I'm glad to know he loves it.
Dan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I am blanking on the name of this movie and the name of the song, but I have a feeling your guest's going to know it. It's with Debbie Reynolds and two guys, and they're singing about having stayed up all night trying to figure out.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes,
yeah, from Singing in the Rain.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a great number. It's a famous, famous number. She's very young, Debbie, and she's dancing with two of the real pros of the Hollywood movie, Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly. And she was not really a hugely trained dancer at that time, but they taught her to do it. She did a beautiful job, and that's an immortal number. Really fun, really fun.
Thanks a lot for the call, Susie. We're talking to Janine Basinger about her new book, The Movie Musical. Back to your calls now with Cindy calling from Appleton. Hey, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I have two of them. First one is The Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand, and then South Pacific. And I'm just wondering, with the popularity of Hamilton, if that may not turn into a movie musical.
Ooh.
Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda is a graduate of our university.
Oh.
And someone that I know, and he certainly will not hesitate to make it into a musical. They definitely plan to make a movie of it. I saw it on Broadway. I don't know if you had the chance to, but it is a work of genius, really wonderful, and I hope they can make a movie out of it that will do it justice. And South Pacific is beautiful. Was that your choice, South Pacific?
That was one of hers, yeah.
It's a beautiful-looking film, but it doesn't quite work for me, although I do like Mitzi Gaynor, and I think she's underrated. It's beautiful-looking, but it kind of, I've seen South Pacific done on stage different times, and I've always enjoyed it more on stage than I did the film. I don't know why that is. It has great music, of course. And what was the other choice?
She had South Pacific and Funny Girl.
Funny Girl, Barbra Streisand is the real deal. I mean, she's an enormous musical talent, and I had not paid as much attention to her before as I ended up doing when I watched every movie. And in particular, when I saw Yentl, which was a movie that did not do well, it did not get great reviews, she did a wonderful job with that film. It's a movie that should be better known, and if you're a Barbra Streisand fan, I recommend it. But Funny Girl is glamorous, and she's wonderful in it.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We'll go now to Keith in Green Bay. Keith, hello.
Hi. I think one of the best musicals is White Christmas because it ticks so many boxes. It's a musical. It's a buddy film. It's got dance. It's Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Rosemary Clooney, Vera Ellen. And the number of musical genres that it hits, ballads, jazzy numbers, modern dance. I mean, it seems to hit them all. And it's a holiday movie as well.
Keith, thanks for the call. White Christmas, that was a big hit, right, Janine?
Oh, yes, a huge hit. And, you know, I couldn't do better than he did in telling what it was. He was perfect. And he's absolutely right. And, of course, it's a musical remake of sorts of the earlier film Holiday Inn, which also had Bing Crosby, but his partner was Fred Astaire. And I like Holiday Inn, which was one of the musicals I saw as a child, as I said earlier. But I think he hit the nail on the head with his description of White Christmas.
Thanks for that call. Deborah is with us now in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hello. Well, I lived in New York City in the 80s, and I worked at Radio City Music Hall for their 50th anniversary show, and it should be a musical. It was extraordinary. But Wizard of Oz is about my favorite, and I saw my very first Broadway show was A Chorus Line. And that would make a great musical movie production also. So.
Deborah, thanks. Chorus Line was a movie, or there was a movie made of it, right?
There was. And it didn't really do justice, I think, to the show. I mean, the show was much better than the musical. Wizard of Oz, of course, you know, is fantastic. And it's a funny thing. It's like my editor and I discuss this a lot. I said, you know, oddly enough, I don't think of The Wizard of Oz as a musical.
Me too. I thought that too.
I know. It's a fantasy. And yet, of course it's a musical.
Right.
Of course it's a musical. But we see it as children, and that's not how we see it. I don't know. It's just a different experience. And yet, of course, it's a great musical. But I had a hard time. He kept saying, what are you writing on? And I said, but Wizard of Oz. And he was like, are you crazy? So, of course, I do write about Wizard of Oz
sure.
a lot. But it's a fantasy for me. It's the Oz books. But it is unquestionably a great movie.
Well, we've got callers on the line we won't have time for mentioning. West Side Story, Annie Get Your Gun, Jesus Christ Superstar, My Fair Lady, so many out there. Janine, I'll say we've had jam-packed phone lines this whole time. There's still an appetite, it seems like, in our last few moments for musicals.
I love all of you out there. I love your choices. I love musicals. It was a labor of love for me to write this book, musicals. I think for those of us who love them, it's we're a tribe, and this is my tribe. Who I'm sorry I don't have a chance to talk to all of you, but go out and get a musical DVD, bring it home, and enjoy your evening.
Janine, thanks so much for joining us. Hope to have you on sometime when you're spending time in Wisconsin again.
Anytime. I love Wisconsin, but I'm sorry to hear you're having snow.
Well, we can do a musical about it. That's Janine Basinger, chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. She's been talking with us about her new book. It's out this week, and it's called The Movie Musical. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Wisconsin producer of a new documentary on PTSD joins the show for a look at how it affects people, the stigma surrounding it, and how people with PTSD are finding different paths to recovery. Plus, we'll hear the argument for the Electoral College. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keely Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, get ready for some collywobbles and snollygosters. What are those? They're two lost words that may be due for a comeback. Hope they're not dirty words. I didn't actually look them up. Keely talks to the author of The Little Book of Lost Words. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. And the new episode of the WPR podcast, Derailed, is out today. This week, we'll get the story of the actual trains. We'll hear about the deal the state made with the Spanish train manufacturer Talgo to build two train sets to be used in Wisconsin, how the deal came together, how it fell apart, and what happened to the trains. Listen online at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up next, it's news. Then flooding took a big toll in southwestern Wisconsin last year. We'll hear about a new project gathering people's stories from the flood. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.